are listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
Joining us today on TWC's Peace Talk Radio Show. TWC's mission in the region is to provide safe, empowering services for families experiencing domestic or sexual violence. We seek to promote violence-free communities through culturally appropriate outreach programs and supportive services. The Peace Talk Radio Show is our opportunity to let the region know what work we are doing and answer questions if people have them. The thrift store is accepting donations, so if you have them, please call TWC to receive instructions on how and where to bring the donations. Please refrain from leaving them outside the thrift store, as those items will be affected by the weather. The thrift store is volunteer-run, so before heading over, please remember to call 907-543-3789. And again, please call TWC to receive instructions on how to bring donations. There are job openings here, so at TWC, so if you're interested in becoming part of the TWC family, you can find the application at www.dunderpeace.org. If you have any information you would like on any of our programs, you can call our 24-hour crisis line at 907-3456, our toll-free at 1-800-478-7799, and our business line at 543-3444. So today we are going to be talking about how we can help those. This is a call-in show, so if you would like more information or would to express any interest in topics surrounding domestic violence or sexual assault, please feel free to call 907-543-5985, 907-543-2756, or 1-800-995-8954. The topic we are going to be talking today is how to help those with addiction, how to help those with mental illness, and how to help those within the LGBTQ community. All statements or opinions shared on the Peace Talk Radio Show are coming from a place of education and collaboration. We do not come from a place of judgment or the idea we know what is best for any person who may be listening. Our goal is to simply share with the community and hopefully learn together. I will say I'm in no way likening being a part of the LGBTQI community to having a mental illness or having an addiction. I'm simply stating that all of these three things and all of these three communities are surrounded by a lot of, stigma and stereotypes, and oftentimes can be looked over when it comes to receiving resources and receiving support. So I am Annie Mae Lee, and I feel I have seen a lot of mental illness, a lot of addiction in my life. And as someone who's a part of the LGBTQIA community, I would like to spread awareness on all of these three things. So I have experienced a lot of trauma, childhood trauma mostly. And these have had like a lot of effects on me, on the way that I behaved, on the way that I interacted with other people, but also it gave me like a couple things that I really had to work through. For the longest time, I did not really go for help from anyone because there was so much conversation around mental illness, and a lot of it seemed very negative and very much like cautionary, rather than just stating it as something that is a part of our society and that we really need to take into account. And I feel that sometimes it's the same. I mean, it's definitely the same when you have addictions. It's really hard to ask for help because you're afraid about how the community will see you, or those people you're receiving services from will see you. And it's very much the same for the LGBTQIA community. So I have been fortunate enough to be able to work with TWC and work with many groups of people and really people from all walks of life. And it's really taught me to kind of look at the way we see services and the way that we actually have our policies and the way that we really interact with people coming in seeking help. And I think that it's really important that these type of conversations happen. So a lot of times I get asked, like, okay, I've struggled with addiction. I have, like, mental illness. And basically, there's really not a lot of education out here on the LGBTQI community, which can make it very difficult to be open about something like that. And those are some things that a lot of people have experienced can really hurt, I guess, their lives, like their livelihood. It can really hurt relationships around them. And I get asked, like, if I have these things, like, what makes me different? And I have different in quotations, like, different from those people who are homeless, feel hopeless, or can't keep a steady income. And what I mean by different is that not that I am exceptionally good, exceptionally better than anyone. I wouldn't even say I'm better than anyone. I'd say that I am exactly those people that you see who maybe don't, are houseless, feel that they have nowhere to turn, or can't keep a steady income, because I have been in situations in my life where I could have jeopardized really all of those things. And I have those people, and I said those people on purpose, and I parenthesize those people because, again, I don't see myself apart from this group of people. I see myself as a part of them because I didn't really grow up in a lot of privilege. I mean, our family came into privilege later in life, and I'll talk a little bit about that. But really, there's nothing separating me from really anyone out there. We all have our traumas, and we all have our issues. I was just fortunate enough to be able to grow up with a lot of safety nets around me. So one thing about growing up, like, really, really poor at the beginning, and really knowing what my mental state was when I was, like, really young, and having addiction and stuff in the household, and having mental illness in the household, when I look back at that and I think about my teen years and how formative that was and how much mentorship it took and how much work it took and how much those small resources really helped, if I hadn't had, like, a roof over my head, or if I had to do something like, for instance, like, help raise siblings, or if I had to do something that really required just the base needs, I don't think I would have, like, been so well in my healing journey, and I'm definitely not done with it. But though having those resources definitely gave me a leg up, I've noticed that all of those things, they're pretty normalized in many ways. Sometimes even just going from house to house is overly normalized, because when you don't have stability in your home, it's really hard to focus on how to move forward. And so the fact that I had stability in my home really, really helped me out. So my connection to multiple community agencies included TWC. I had people I considered safe adults and trustworthy adults within the school. I had church, and I will say I'm very openly not really participating in organized religion right now, but I do see that it really builds a community around teens and kids, and it has all of the building blocks of having a great resilience factor. So another thing that I'm really privileged to have is that my family is generally accepting of my choices as they are my choices. Without the acceptance and support of my family, and I'm not going to say acceptance as in they accept every single one of my behaviors and they enable me and they just don't have any problems with the lifestyle I live. What I'm saying is that they have made it clear that they will always be behind me. And so have my siblings, and so have a lot of my friends, and so have many of the community members that are here today. And so I just want to acknowledge that. And then the last thing that I feel I'm very, very happy for, and it seems a little strange to say this, but I'm really happy that my family has experienced addiction and mental illness in many forms. And because of that, I mean, they've had to learn. And they've had to go through a lot of things that really helped them get rid of some of those stigmas around all these three things. And that's why I kind of want to talk about it today. I'm really acknowledging the privilege that I have and really how much of things that I haven't experienced. But I want to talk about a little bit about sorry, I'm very stuttery, a little bit about how I see some things around me and some different things that I see around the community. So I want to say that there are still some ways we react to the LGBTQIA community, people with addiction, and people with mental illness. And sometimes that makes it hard for them to come forward and ask for help. It may be that we don't know how to support. It may be that we have views and ideas about these things that really don't seem to set right. And really, the thing is, it's really hard to ask for help, especially if you're going through a domestically violent relationship, or you've experienced like a lot of trauma or violence. And it's really hard for anyone to ask for help. But when you are often like overlooked or ignored in like violent scenarios, we kind of don't really see them as much. And so we would like to either say that they don't really happen that often, or we would like to say that it's because of the addiction, or it's because of the mental illness that they're saying this, or we might really start to, I guess, experience a lot of compassion fatigue. And what I mean by compassion fatigue is, I'll give you an example. I had someone who kept losing their protective order, and I was a legal advocate at this time. What happened was that they lost maybe their protective order 3 times. They had a heavy addiction, but they really needed this protective order. And I found myself being like, oh my God, she's here again, getting another protective order. I'm kind of tired of this. Now, of course, I didn't say that out loud, and I very much checked myself after that, because I really needed to like remember that I'm here for this, and that this person is in need of a lot of support and a lot of assistance. And that in order to keep my compassion, I need to really look at it from her perspective. And that's what I mean by like compassion fatigue. Sometimes like you just get a little tired, and this can often be seen when it comes to specifically people with, say, like addiction, but it can definitely go for people who are in relationships as well. So sometimes we may think that it's because of mental illness or addiction that people are acting out or behaving or misbehaving. And sometimes we see things that really don't, I guess, again, sit right with us, or that really we don't understand, because it goes against what we would believe in our minds who aren't in this. And they're behaviors that we would see as detrimental. These behaviors are things like going back over and over again to the partners that abuse them or treat them badly. And I'm going to say that I said that this is for people with addictions and mental illness, but it's also for the LGBTQI community. And that when you are in an abusive relationship, you feel that you have a lack of options. You might be told over and over again that because you're this, because you have an addiction, because you're mentally ill, because you're gay and no one's going to accept you, that, again, no one's going to accept you, that they are their only option. And so sometimes it can be really hard to really look at it from another perspective, because you're hearing it over and over and over again. And that can sometimes really grate at your self-worth and really grate at really resolve, because leaving an abusive relationship without that feeling, and I will say this is also a very common feeling just in general domestic violence relationships, is really hard enough without being a part of these communities. And sometimes oftentimes being a part of these communities can make it more difficult. You can see people going further into addiction and never showing that they care to stop. And I'm going to say that just that end part of what I said, that they don't care to stop, is not the reason they're not stopping. Addiction is neurological. It literally changes the way your brain works. It turns something that could be occasional, like alcohol or something, into a need. It's not just a craving. It physically hurts you to not have it. It becomes a priority because it carves its way into your brain. So there are actually a lot of studies and a lot of, like, just a lot of people have, I guess, identified that this is a neurological condition and can be called a disease. So they might be violent physically or verbally, but we got to remember that oftentimes people come in with a lot of trauma, especially if they're dealing with domestic violence and sexual assault. They might already have a natural distrust for agencies. They might already have a natural distrust toward people who are trying to help, because oftentimes people in these communities are overlooked or maybe not helped in the best way because of who they are. And sometimes this distrust can be like shown by violent behavior. And I'm not condoning violence in any way, but I think that we need to know where some of these behaviors come from in order to understand where these people are coming from. Now, the last one I'm going to say is, and there's definitely a lot more, but these are the ones that came up in my head, is being verbally violent or physically violent with their children. Again, this is not something that should ever be excused. It should never be excused in any way. I am a mandated reporter. If I see anything like that, then I will report. But it's really, really, really important that you understand that trauma can really affect you. And trauma and domestic violence can take away your power. And someone who feels powerless might decide to take power from another person. I mean, that's what domestic violence is. And domestic violence can be towards children as well. Again, and I will not stress this enough, I do not condone any violence towards children. I will report if I hear about it. So, another thing that can be really hard when you're a part of the LGBT community, have an addiction, or have a mental illness, is that just like with domestic or sexual violence in a relationship, when people are judging your relationship with your partner, placing the blame on your gender, or placing the blame of your actions on them, it could really make it hard to come to someone for support. And that's one thing that I think people really need to understand. So, when you're a victim of violence and it's hard to come for someone for support and ask for help, it feels almost impossible. I am right now not in a violent relationship, have not really experienced any recent traumas, and I have trouble asking for help and support. So, again, I will say that though these have not been my experiences, I know that I'm fortunate to have multiple safety nets, and I just want to bring that up one more time. So I'm going to talk a little bit about misconceptions specifically about the LGBTQIA that we need to address in the community. And that is that because people in LGBTQIA in the community and those relationships aren't the majority of the reports, that it happens less often than with straight couples. And I will say that the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence says that 43.8% of lesbian women and 61.1% of bisexual women have experienced sexual assault, physical violence, and or stalking by an intimate partner at some point in their lifetime, as opposed to 35% of heterosexual women. 26% of gay men and 37.3% of bisexual men have experienced sexual assault, physical violence, and or stalking by an intimate partner in their lifetime, in comparison to 29% of heterosexual men. In a study of male same-sex relationships, only 20% of men called the police for assistance after experiencing near-lethal violence. In 2012, fewer than 5% of LGBTQ survivors of intimate partner violence sought orders of protection. Transgender victims are more likely to experience interpartner violence in public compared to those who do not identify as transgender. Bisexual victims are more likely to experience sexual violence compared to people who do not identify as bisexual. And LGBTQ victims on public assistance are more likely to experience intimate partner violence compared to those who are not on public assistance. Now, I will say that even though it seems like those are really close, we have to understand that we're also looking at how often in these relationships that violence is reported. Now, we also know that men in general do not report as much as women. So I will want to actually put that one out there. So what is happening is that these instances are not being reported as much due to fear of not being helped or making things worse. And that is something that's very much alive in all relationships. But it can be especially terrifying when you have a lot of this agency trauma, or these times where you've reached out and maybe didn't get the support you wanted, or a support that was helpful. And that's really, really common because, again, some people aren't educated and don't really aren't educated about this and don't really know how to support the people that are around them. So I want to say that just because there are high rates of domestic violence in the LGBTQI community, that it is more dangerous in relationships. And I'm not going to say that this is not outright true, because really there are a lot of violence in relationships, and just being in an LGBTQI community does not mean that it's more dangerous. But one thing is that a lot of times violence between LGBTQI people is very, very, again, underreported. There's a lot of secrecy, and there's just a lot of confusion around that topic. So I will say that because things are so quiet and because the reports are so low, that would be one reason why. Another thing is that we don't talk about scenarios or dynamics that are specifically in LGBTQ relationships. I didn't really learn what domestic violence looks like in an LGBTQI relationship that could be different. Like, for instance, threatening to out someone to their family or their friends. There's purposely misgendering people to make them feel bad and feeding into their body dysphoria. Things like that I've never really thought about because it didn't really apply as much. And another misconception is that, and I'm sorry that I have to say this, but it's a scenario that I've seen played on the internet and sometimes talked about in real life, is that having non-consensual sex with an LGBTQI person is okay because they like whatever gender this person is. And that is not true. Attraction is individual. And consent is still very much a real and practiced thing in the LGBTQI community. And oftentimes, it should be emphasized in the LGBTQIA conversations, or needs to be. There's reasons for that, and these are that. When we have heterosexual relationships, and I'm not saying that this should apply to anyone, and I'm definitely not saying that this is something I necessarily subscribe to, is that there's already gender roles, there's already sexual roles that are already set. And these are something that's really common knowledge. But when you are in an LGBTQI relationship, you really have to talk about what your likes and dislikes are, what your boundaries are. Because there is no gender roles in this scenario. Now, you might have to discuss having things like body dysphoria or your needs changing as you change. And that's really important because sex should be enthusiastic and enjoyable. And then sometimes you need to talk about safest practices. So I just want to talk a little bit about that. So misconceptions about people with addictions and mental illness is that they're always in control of themselves in their actions and they are choosing to misbehave. And I talked about this before. This is brain chemistry and it's recognized as a neurological disorder. Just because something is inconvenient doesn't mean that that thing's not scary or just as confusing or something that they necessarily have any type of control over. So we really need to be empathetic and we really need to understand. So we have had people come in with mental illness, with things that just didn't make sense. But we needed to let them know that they felt safer. So we helped them in any way that we can. We don't turn people away because of things like acting out. So they don't reach out because they don't want to get better. But when you have an addiction, it takes over your thoughts. And I can often hear sometimes stories of people who literally go to buy drugs or go to buy alcohol, and it feels like they do it on autopilot. It's not that they don't or they're resisting help. Most times it's that they have such emotional and physical symptoms from stopping that it could feel impossible, and that feeling can be hopeless. And I just want to get that out there. Another misconception is that they choose their addictions over their partner, kids, friends, families, jobs. It doesn't feel like a choice. It feels like needing water because your brain is convinced that it is a necessity. And the last one, and this is one thing that I really hate to hear, is that people made their choices and should live with it. I've never really seen anyone say, I choose to be addicted to alcohol. I choose to be addicted to insert other thing here. And addictions don't always just happen slowly. It really can depend on a lot of things. It could depend on your lifestyle, your mental state. It could depend on your past traumas, just many things, your environment. And so, yes, they made a choice when they've had, like, when they started what they got addicted to. But it doesn't feel like a choice. It feels like a necessity. And it also is something that's so individual, we can't put a blanket over it. So now that I kind of talked a little bit about things that I've heard, a little bit about what I've seen, what can we as a community do to make our spaces and conversations more available to these communities? And the first thing I would say is to advertise that you're accepting and you want them at the table. We want people from all walks of life to share their experiences and really share their input if we want our agency services to make real change and lasting changes. So we need to do that as holistically as possible. One thing that I love, and I was talking to her, I'm just going to call her JJ, was talking to me, and we were thinking about normalizing conversations about things like addictions. And Jay told me, like, I have this shirt that says, I love drug addicts. And it kind of took me back a little bit. I was thinking, oh, I love drug addicts. That's a little bit of a bold thing to put on a shirt. But then she kind of started talking to me about how she just wants to get the message out there that we could still show support for people with addictions to drugs. And we can still let people know that we love them with their addiction. Not that we love their addiction. So we also at TAV, as soon as LGBTQIA and like ally signs or that TWC is a safe space signs, we had a lot of people come in. And they haven't always been necessarily there for a long time. But letting like kids know in the community that there's a safe space for them to be themselves or be allies to their peers really, really brought a lot of, I guess, it brought out a lot of people who felt like they weren't going to be heard. And the last you can do is reach out to those who you see struggling and let them know you care that they are, and that you care that they're trying to be better or better their situation or relationships in life. Now, I understand that there's not a lot, like, you can't just, like, go to someone who has an addiction. There are many reasons why you can't just go and, like, give them the resources that you have, or maybe you can't spend a lot of time with them. Maybe you're a recovering addict, or maybe a recovering person with an addiction, and maybe you don't have the means to do so. But just letting someone know that they're being seen and that their efforts are being recognized and valued is really important, even just for the most of us. So these are really, really simple things you can do. But as soon as we normalize conversations, normalize, like, finding ways to support and really educate our community on truths rather than what we think about people who have mental illness, addiction, or in the LGBTQIA community, is really the most important things. Because you can't have someone at the table if you won't acknowledge them. So thank you again for listening to TWC's Peace Talk Radio Show. Again, this is Annie Mae Lee, your host. If you have any questions and would like to know more about TWC and our programs, please call our 24-hour crisis line at 907-543-3456. The toll-free number at 1-800-478-7799. And the Bethel Local Business Line at 907-543-3444.
Thank you for listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Catch us every Wednesday at 10 a.m. right here on KYUK.